Okay, here we go. This is Mark Schenker on behalf of the Society of Addiction Psychology, and this month we're having a one of our monthly conference calls. We're happy to have Matthew Johnson from Johns Hopkins presenting. He's an associate professor of psychiatry, done a lot of research on psychedelic therapy for, what is it, about 20 years or so?
About 15 myself, yeah.
Oh, okay, well, my math...
Pretty good chunk of time, but...
Before we get going, I've got a couple of my normal announcements. And first is, if anybody wants to discuss any clinical material, please be sure to be aware that this is being recorded and respect confidentiality. The second thing, I'm going to say this twice, is please press your mute button so we don't have to listen to all the background noise. Also, we had a problem last time. Somebody put their call on hold, and everybody was listening to Muzak for a while. So please don't put your call on hold, or we're all listening to Bonnie. Our next call will be February 7th. Bruce will be talking about the call in a minute. We don't. We're not going to do a call in January. And I think, Bruce, why don't you make your announcement, and then we'll get started with Dr. Johnson.
My pleasure. Thank you very much. Yes, for those of you who don't know me, my name is Bruce Leese. I am a psychologist who has been involved with Division 50 for since it was born, and past president. And something we have never done in our division that we are ready to start thinking about seriously is a conference specifically for our members. And that doesn't mean other people won't be involved or invited, but really completely revolving around clinicians' interest in Division 50. So, in short, an addiction psychology clinical conference sponsored by Division 50. I sent out an email to our division on the listserv. You should have gotten it. There's a link. The thing that's going to be crazy good about this upcoming conference, if we do it, is that it will be planned based on input by everybody who responds to all of my queries. So please take a look for that email. If you haven't gotten it, email me. Please think about what you would want in your ideal continuing education with credit conference, and let me know. And then I'm going to have a town hall. I am also the Division 50 member at large for practice. So we're going to have a town hall on February 7th as our clinical conference call. And during that time, we will those on the call will have a chance to talk about what their areas of interest are and what their practice is like. And we'll have a discussion rather than a presentation. So in review, in five words or less, February 7th, town hall, this phone number, thanks to Mark Schenker. And then please respond to the survey query I sent last night. That's it. And somebody's left their mute button off, and it sounds like they're slogging through the snow, so everybody should have their mute button on. Mark, thank you.
All right, thank you. And don't worry, I'll be sending out reminders at the end of January. And so with no further ado, Dr. Johnson, the floor is yours.
Okay, thanks so much.
And everybody, don't forget to press your mute button, which I'm about to do.
And I have unpressed my mute button, so yeah, thanks a lot, Mark. Appreciate the invitation, roping me into this. So I'm in my last month as the Division 28 president, so it's a particular honor to be chatting with our colleagues at our sister Division 50 on one of the areas that I look at in my research. So something that occurs to me now that I'm actually on the phone about to run through these slides, given that you were all sent the file, a lot of times I talk with an individual bullet point coming in each time. As you, you know, click the button to go to the next slide, you'll actually just get the next bullet point. So trying to think, you know, in navigating that, I'll just I guess I'll kind of let you know when it's time to go to the next slide, just in case there's points to be clicked through. So it's a different format for me, so apologies if that makes it a little bit awkward. But going on to my second slide, Just some acknowledgments. I'm showing you a whole lot of work. I've surely forgotten some people to thank here, but I'm showing you some work over more than 15 years here. Number of colleagues, certainly want to thank Roland, who many of you probably know, and other faculty members here at Hopkins, Al Garcia, Fred Barrett, funding largely from certainly for the therapeutic research, all from nonprofit foundations supporting this work. So then I'll go to my next slide. This is just sort of letting you know about some recent exciting news with our group. We received, and this is the page you'll see the New York Times article on the right, but we recently, within the last few months, received center-level funding for our research with psychedelics, and particularly looking at their therapeutic uses, so funded by the Cohen Foundation and the Tim Ferriss Collaborative. And if you click through your button several times, you'll go through my bullet points. We'll just be looking at this is all psilocybin, the active agent in mushrooms, and we'll be looking at a number of therapeutic studies, including ones that I'll be PI on, treatment of opioid addiction and PTSD, but then also studies on anorexia treatment, comorbid alcoholism with depression, mood issues in Alzheimer's disease, and also in post-treatment Lyme disease, what's been called chronic Lyme disease syndrome. It looks like there's actually a real phenomenon there for a subset of people, but looking at mood issues and that emerging disorder, and also looking at some healthy normals outside of therapeutic use. Look at some of these other interesting questions with high doses of with psilocybin. We'll be looking at so-called microdosing, or these sub-threshold psychoactive doses, and seeing if some of these anecdotes actually hold up true. I bet there's a lot of placebo effect there, and the current lab studies elsewhere suggest there's not a whole lot there, but we'll dig into it a little bit further with microdosing of psilocybin to see if there's some psychological benefit, and certainly if there's downsides. And then also looking at high-dose psilocybin on creativity, and that's my last bullet point. Oh, no, it's not. We also have a genetic and other biomarkers core looking across all of these studies to look at potential correlates of treatment response in terms of pre and post data, but then also looking at these markers in terms of the pre data as predictors of a potential therapeutic response. So now I'm on the slide with the big old picture of the mushrooms in someone's hand on the right. So psilocybin, active agent, and a wide variety of mushroom species, mostly in the psilocybe genera. It's a classic psychedelic, and so this is different than other drugs that are sometimes called psychedelic, like MDMA or ketamine. Those have fundamentally different mechanisms of action. So these psychedelics are serotonin 2A receptor agonists, and so other ones include LSD, mescaline, which is in peyote, dimethyltryptamine, which is in ayahuasca, and there are a variety of other synthetic classic psychedelic 2A agonists. Next slide, primary role for the 2A receptor, just several major lines of evidence. We know these drugs produce solid discriminative stimulus effects in non-humans. So antagonizing the 2A receptor in humans will block its subjective effects, and in non-humans certainly blocks their discriminative stimulus effects. And then on the third bullet point, I'm showing you that serotonin 2A affinity is remarkably well correlated with human potency, and there's also tight correlations between animal and non-humans affinity and potency. And by potency, I mean the strict pharmacological definition of how much mass of the substance you actually need to achieve a threshold psychoactive effect. Now I'm on to my next slide, labeled ritualistic use. It dates back millennia, so several hundred to a couple of thousand years in the Americas, some solid evidence for that. A little more controversial, I think probably convincing, is data I'm showing you on the far right from cave paintings in North Africa suggesting use that dates back around 10,000 years ago. So this would predate, civilization. So the first civilizations that cropped up in Mesopotamia. So quite an interesting history here, and prehistory, I should say. Next slide, labeled 1940s through 70s. particularly with the advent of LSD, psychedelics were intensely investigated as research tools and therapeutics during this era. It was really the discovery of LSD, its similarity to serotonin, that was right around the same time that we were learning that serotonin doesn't just show up in the gut, it's this thing in the brain, and this was at the time when we were starting to understand this thing called neurotransmission, and that's how the brain worked. And so, and the idea that there was a really remarkable potency of LSD having strong effects on subjective experience at very low doses really was a strong cue that this whole idea of neurotransmission, that we were onto something. So it really played out this it wasn't solely responsible, but played this really fascinating role with other emerging research in kind of the development of the modern biobehavioral model of the mind, of brain function, if you will. And then you had these promising therapeutic findings. And there was some variability, but two main threads of the most promising research was using, and this was largely LSD, treating cancer-related distress. These were, in these studies, terminal patients who essentially had existential distress. It's not in the DSM. Some emerging research suggests that it is a distinct thing, distinct from depression and other and anxiety disorders. But this kind of constellation of depressive and anxious symptoms that you get with not everyone, but with a number of folks with a terminal illness and with end of life in general. And then also this research looking at largely LSD to treat alcoholism. And there was one study also on LSD and treatment of opioid addiction that looked promising, although it was early. So next slide. This is kind of the funky one labeled the Dark Ages, where, you know, you see kind of this, like, medieval scene. clicking through the bullet points, making the point that despite some promising early findings, all of this research became dormant for at least a couple of decades. And this was a really reaction to the association of LSD largely with the counterculture of the 60s and early 70s, and also the very real casualties that did result from the reckless use outside of the clinic. And to be clear, I mean, there were definitely casualties, and it's also important to note that the average dose of LSD on the street was 300 micrograms. That's a very high dose. The average dose of LSD these days is somewhere around 40 to 50 micrograms. So huge difference there. Surely played some of the role of in people showing up to emergency departments having acute psychiatric distress. But importantly here, there was not a convincing scientific argument made that you simply cannot conduct medical and psychological research with these compounds safely. This was really largely a product of the worst of what we saw in, you know, kind of the Wild West of illicit use in the wild. And the salient and over-representative attention that a small number of researchers, really the group at Harvard with Tim Leary, that they got. There were many more boring researchers the public doesn't remember that were begging Leary to tone it down, to be more clear about the risks, and certainly once he was kicked out of Harvard, you know, begging him not to encourage, like, widespread use. So, unfortunately, that type of stuff got most of the media attention. So then on to the next slide, abuse, liability, and risks. I won't delve into all of these for risk of time, but we know a lot about the relevant risks, the main ones being it does appear that people with a psychotic predisposition can have lasting harms by taking high doses of these substances. And for anyone, there's the bad trip phenomenon where there can be anxiety and panic behavior, which can sometimes lead to dangerous and even potentially fatal behavior in unsafe settings. And some other relatively mild medical risks. They're remarkably safe, particularly psilocybin, physiologically, although most of the harms are in the behavioral and psychiatric level. And then I'm sort of within my slide with the emerging bullet points on abuse liability and risks. I have inserted a slide on headaches. We published some systematic research on that showing that psilocybin causes headaches in the day following its use, typically in the mild to moderate range, nothing that would prevent research. Might be a clue to understanding some other research, some stuff going on at Yale following it up, suggesting psilocybin could actually be used to treat migraines and cluster headaches. So back to the next slide. This jumps you back to the abuse liability list here. There's also this very rare disorder of hallucinogen persisting perceptual disorder. Important thing about that, it appears to be exclusively related to recreational use. Never been found in the earlier or current era of clinical research with these compounds, so it could be a product of polysubstance use, impure product, uncontrolled dose, frequent use, a whole variety of factors that are going to be more at play with use in the wild. So, but nonetheless, something to keep probing for in conducting this research. An important risk on the final point in that page is that although certainly psilocybin and other classic psychedelics can function as drugs of abuse, kind of using the older DSM-4 language, in other words, the type of use that causes harm to the self or others, it's very clear they're not typically drugs of compulsive drug seeking or addiction. So we know that from the way they work in the mesolimbic. We know that from the failure to function as reinforcers and operant models and non-humans. And just from the large-scale epidemiology, where if you really drill into the classic psychedelics, you don't get frequent, compulsive drug seeking. For example, daily use patterns. So then the next slide, just showing you some guidelines we published in 2008. We now know that the FDA are using these guidelines, thankfully. This is one of the things we really hoped for, using them to help evaluate new protocols that are being evaluated for these compounds. And we know that from clinicaltrials.gov, there's over 30 active studies in the U.S. Using psilocybin. Our strong hope is that when people are adopting this, what we think is very promising research, that they're very mindful of the real risks and that there are safeguards. And kind of just to make a point about that list of risks, the really important thing is that we have, for all of the relevant risks, we have very good mitigating strategies to drastically reduce those risks through screening, through monitoring, and follow-up care. So let's see, next slide. This is the one with the person laying on the couch, just kind of showing you that the context including the interpersonal environment seems to play a powerful role. Having a comforting environment, including having people that they've gotten to know, built rapport with, is helpful in minimizing anxiety and particularly minimizing paranoid reactions at high doses. So next slide. Briefly, just some of our early research with healthy normals suggested that a high dose of psilocybin was safe in this structured setting, and remarkably, the majority of people found the experience to be one of the top most meaningful experiences of their life, which is saying a lot considering you're on laying on a couch in a hospital in Baltimore, of all cities. And then the next slide, or next bullet point, remarkably, there were reports of improvement in mood and quality of life over a year after sessions, not just from the participants, but through community observers. These would be spouses, coworkers, family members, friends who agreed to, sign consent to be surveyed about the main research participant throughout the study. So, and then the next slide, the dose effect study. Although certainly these other factors, the context, the preparation is all part of the recipe for achieving, these highly, these apparently positive looking effects, it's also clear that you've got some real pharmacology going on here. We did a double-blind study with true placebo plus four active doses and found just a beautiful dose-related relationship between, one of these, not typical pharmacological measures here I'm showing you, the percentage of participants rating the experience amongst the five most spiritually significant of their life. So nice dose-related relationship there. Next slide is labeled mystical experience. I'll refer to this a couple times when I'm going through these the rest of the slides, but it sounds a little woo-woo, but it's not so much when you delve into it. It actually goes back as a psychological construct to William James, the founder of American psychology. I'll explain a little more what I mean by that, but remarkably, 60%, over half of the folks in these first couple of studies met criteria on a scale for a so-called complete mystical experience, meaning they indicated strong endorsement for several subjective experiences during it. And so here I'm giving you a list of what those types of things are. The important thing to realize is this construct has origins outside of drug research. This really comes from largely religious, but not always, just extraordinary human experiences, you know, very unusual experiences that if you survey the population are not – Bill Miller's done some work on this – they're not infrequent, but they're infrequent to happen with any short times, you know, time frame for someone, you know, like next week. But in terms of it occurring once or a few times in someone's life, it's not that – unusual. But these extraordinary experiences that constitute this mystical experience involved, here I'm going through the bullet points in that slide, overwhelming sense of unity, like feeling one with everything, one with the universe, one with all of humankind, one with life on Earth, that type of thing. Then having a noetic quality, the sense that there's some sort of self-validating truth to the experience, a sense of sacredness, or of a sense that whatever experience deserves to be taken extremely seriously, a sense of transcending or stepping outside of the bounds of time and space, sort of those psychological dimensions seem less meaningful so people can collapse into the present moment, for example, a sense of positive mood, and then a sense of ineffability. In other words, you know, people will say something like, my word, I could never fully describe what just happened to me. But nonetheless, then we give them a bunch of scales and say, okay, but do your best to describe it. So next slide, I'm just showing you that we've developed the first, even though there were previous measures that we'd used in our early research, we've developed through both survey research on psychedelics and our lab research the first psychometrically validated scale of mystical experience to look at acute experiences, so not across the lifespan, but acutely, something that comes from, like, say, drug administration. So that's called the MEQ30. And going on to the next slide here, labeled psilocybin openness, through combining our first two healthy normal slides, we found that kind of defying the definition of personality, which implies some stability, we found, to our knowledge, the first experimental study to show a change in a validated personality dimension due to an experimental manipulation. So there are some trends across the lifespan and from major life events, but to our knowledge, never had it been shown that a relatively discrete laboratory intervention caused a personality shift. So we got an increase in openness on the neo-personality inventory, which refers to a tolerance for the beliefs of others, the ability to hold seemingly mutually exclusive beliefs at the same time, kind of like an either a both-and rather than an either-or mentality, a tolerance for other people's points of view, I think I said that, and also an appreciation for aesthetics. So that's sort of personality openness. And then in terms of – we found that it was driven by mystical experience, the ratings for mystical experience on the session day. So if you go to the next slide, I'm showing you a figure that even though the effect was strong enough that we got these – significant effect of a change, an increase in personality openness for everyone that received psilocybin. If you dug into the data further, like I'm showing you, it's kind of interesting that it wasn't just psilocybin. It was specifically those people that had this mystical type experience with psilocybin that drove that increase in personality openness. So moving on to the next slide. I think I showed you this already, but the session room with the volunteer and our nice lab setting. Now I'm moving on to some of the therapeutic research. I'll go through this pretty quickly because I want to get more to the addiction stuff, but we did this study following up in the old LSD research with cancer patients. They all had a serious cancer diagnosis and also satisfied one of a number of DSM disorders, about a third involving depression symptoms, about a third some type of anxiety disorder, and about a third of folks met criteria for a depression-related or and an anxiety disorder. So a mixture of these things. Next slide, study design. It was a crossover study. So basically every person had a trivial dose, really not even designed to have any effect at all, really to just control for expectancy. So we can honestly tell people every session would be a dose of psilocybin. So everyone had a trivial dose and a high dose of psilocybin. So those two sessions, just the order of them was randomized into two groups, high first, low second, or vice versa. Before the crossover, there was 5 weeks where we had a follow-up to assess the effects of the first session before they got the other condition they hadn't received in the first session. And then 5 weeks later, a follow-up, and then a six-month follow-up. Next slide, labeled serious adverse events. There were no serious AEs attributable to psilocybin, thankfully, probably largely thanks to our rigorous safety mitigating factors at play. And I'm showing you on the next slide lasting antidepressant and anxiety effects. At baseline, people came in with clinically severe levels of depression and anxiety. I'm showing you the Hamilton inventories here. At post one on each slide, this is after the high dose group has had a high dose and the other group in blue has had a low dose. You see a dramatic decrease in high dose group to on average not clinically severe levels, really a normal range. Some reduction in the low dose or trivial dose group, likely due to both placebo effect and just the solid rapport building and preparation that's done. Which is very therapeutic-like, you know, this rapport building, and with a lot of life review, things like this, talking about their cancer. But nonetheless, then you have the crossover, and so post two, which is 5 weeks after, you know, the second, you know, drug session, where now everyone has had the high-dose psilocybin either 5 or 10 weeks beforehand, now you see both groups on average were down to that very low level. And then, remarkably, that remained virtually unchanged at 6 months. So the same general pattern is there for depression and anxiety. And this mirrors results we saw on a number of other validated measures as well. Next slide, I'm showing you that mystical experience is significantly correlated with these therapeutic effects. So the reductions in anxiety and depression showed a relationship, modest but statistically significant. So you know, the experience on session day had something to seem to be associated with that long-term therapeutic improvement. And the other interesting thing is that this held up even after controlling for ratings of drug intensity. So this is, we find this time and time again in healthy normals and cancer patients, and I'll show you with cigarette smoking cessation. It seems to be that that this relationship between subjective effects and long-term outcomes is not just getting hit over the head with a sledgehammer. It's something about the nature, the qualitative nature, not just the strength of the drug experience, but the psychological nature of the experience that is predictive or at least associated with long-term outcome. And then the slide labeled consistent findings. There was this earlier study by our colleague Charlie Grobe with about half the dose at UCLA in 2011, and concurrently published with ours a smaller study with about the same high dose at New York University. That was a study in 29 folks. Those were both with cancer patients. And then outside of cancer, our colleague Robin Carhart-Harris at London Imperial College found in an open-label study with major depressive disorder some substantial reductions in depression up to 3 months after treatment. Then in our next slide, depression pilot, this is in our hands. This isn't published yet, but this is one step beyond what Robin did in London. It's a randomized wait list control, so people are randomized to either get this open label high-dose psilocybin session, you know, more immediately. There were still the preparation sessions in rapport building, but then or they got the psilocybin session, told to wait and get it later on, several weeks later. And so you can see the reduction in depression symptoms here. This is a version of the Hamilton Depression Inventory. You see that closely monitored, followed, you know, when they got the psilocybin. So that's interesting. Hopefully, with any luck, that'll be peer-reviewed and published. Now I'm moving on to our addiction treatment portion. So this is the slide labeled addiction treatment. So just reiterating that point, it's kind of important to, you know, it's kind of nice if a drug that's used to treat addiction is not addictive itself. It certainly doesn't preclude its use if it is. You know, we have several examples, obviously, of substitution or agonist treatment in the field that are empirically validated. But it's a cherry on top if the drug itself is not addictive. So that's the case for the classic psychedelics, it would appear. However, just because you're not going to get hooked on psilocybin in terms of compulsive drug seeking, you know, doesn't answer the question, well, why in the world would you think this would, like, help people with addiction? So a couple of threads of evidence. There's that older research with LSD. Kind of it was considered a mixed bag in earlier reviews, but some colleagues in Norway looked back several years back at only the randomized control trials, and there were only six of them. So these were randomized open-label studies where people were randomized to LSD or some other comparator condition, and they conducted a meta-analysis and found that there was a significant effect, even though a number of these originally there were low-end studies. You know, a lot of them showed a trend, but you know, failed to reach significance. But there was a clearly significant effect in aggregate. That's what I'm showing you at the large diamond at the bottom. But you know, more important than these statistical significance is the effect size. So with the odds ratio of about 2, so what that means is, LSD nearly doubled the odds that a patient would be improved at the first follow-up. And the time point of that follow-up varied across studies, but certainly very promising. And this is, you know, this is data that should have followed up if it wasn't for the political baggage. Really, it should have been followed up decades ago because these are very promising results from these imperfect initial studies. The next slide is just this is sort of with the teepee in the background, just describing this anthropological literature. Certainly not experimental, can't definitively show causation for sure, but observationally quite intriguing. So the ceremonial use of these 2A agonists, classic psychedelics, has been linked with addiction recovery. So examples come from peyote use in the Native American church. And also, it's associated with ayahuasca ceremonies. Addiction recovery is associated with ayahuasca ceremonies in South America, indigenous societies, and also in South American syncretic religions. But again, there's some caveats there. We know religious involvement in general can be associated with addiction recovery, but suggestive. So now moving on to the next, our pilot study with smoking cessation. This was just, we had basically a little bit of money. I had a lot of experience. I think I started this in my postdoc back in, when we started the study, probably like 2007 or so. It took us a while to finally finish the study and get something published, but I had a good amount of research in smoking. So I thought, you know, I'm a behaviorist at heart, and I thought, well, I'm fascinated by all the William James mystical experience stuff, but let's see the rubber meet the road. I want to see some behavior and some behavior that I can really biologically verify. So smoking cessation is very attractive for that, and it's obviously a real deal addiction. I don't have to tell this group. And so this was a small feasibility study. I'm going on to the next slide. I'm preaching to the choir here, but in terms of more, it's all beyond being a good model addiction. It's also kind of a problem itself, smoking. So in terms of mortality, it kills many times more people than all other forms of substance use combined, so nearly 500,000 people in the U.S. per year. Huge unmet need, most people in the U.S. wanting to seek, you know, want to quit. So moving on to the next slide. This is kind of my funny slide with the bowl of mushrooms from the Newsweek. You know, we don't control, sometimes this stuff gets some media, which we appreciate. You can't control really the message that gets out. But I like to joke that we don't encourage any use at home or, you know, outside of a medical context. But certainly we don't encourage this because that's a whole lot of mushrooms on that plate. So, yeah. Moving on to the next slide. Demographics, the important thing here, these were 15 folks. These are real deal smokers, had been smoking on an average of about 30 years and had smoked almost a pack a day on average. Then the pilot study timeline, it was a 15-week protocol. It included cognitive behavioral therapy, three psilocybin sessions over an 8-week period, moving from a moderate to high dose. The CBT was not during the psilocybin session. It was done in the preparation sessions on other days before the psilocybin and then intermixed throughout, but not on the same session. So just like our healthy normal studies and all of our studies at these high doses, it seems best to just encourage the person to introspect, basically. Trust, let go, be open. The people in the room are there for psychological support should some anxiety creep up. But all the CBT comes before and after. There is some discussion of the experience of what it might mean for smoking at the end of the day. But yeah, next point, let's see. The first psilocybin session is on the target quit date. So that's a big day for people. You're quitting smoking and you're getting this big old dose of a powerful psychedelic. Again, next slide, no adverse events, thankfully. Again, largely, we think probably attributable to all the safety mechanisms we have in place. Then the next slide, I'm showing you a graph. You'll have to keep hitting your next button to kind of click through our data. My data points are dropping in, but showing you carbon monoxide. We looked at cotinine in the urine and carbon monoxide. They tell the same story. So results, if you click it once, it shows you before exposure to psilocybin on the target quit date, and then after. You see, obviously, the median data suggests a large reduction pre and post in this biological metric. On the next slide, I'm showing you 7-day point prevalence data in the 15 folks. That showed 80% folks were biologically confirmed smoke-free at 6 months. And at a very long-term follow-up at 2.5 years, that held up to 60%. So these are obviously extremely high abstinence rates for smoking cessation interventions. We can't say anything strong about causality. My next slide, big grain of salt here, success rate substantially higher than typical. Not a fair comparison because we're looking across different studies, different methods, different populations, but nonetheless, just to give a flavor, and this is typically for audiences that don't have an addiction background, but just why, in terms of the absolute level of success, we thought, okay, this is worthy enough for follow-up. So moving on, I'm showing you mystical experiences were related to outcomes of greater success in smoking cessation at 6 months. We found that in people with higher mystical experience scores, and we also found a significant correlation between mystical experience and craving reduction. Next, and then we did some qualitative analysis. For the sake of time, we'll go through this pretty quickly. Just people had a lot of interesting things to say. They did think that the people that quit thought that the psilocybin, all of them thought that it played a strong role in helping them quit. Some big points, they thought it helped with their withdrawal. They claimed some powerful insights into self-identity and how smoking, the role of smoking in their life, their sort of personal reasons for smoking. Moving on to the next slide, comparative efficacy trial. That's the trial we're currently in. Using the same general methods, but it's an 80 treatment-resistant smokers randomized to psilocybin or nicotine patch. So it's still open label. I'm actually hoping to get some funding to do some double-blind research with a larger N. So the same cognitive behavioral therapy backdrop. We've scaled back a little bit back in terms of not quite as many weeks of ongoing CBT. And then we had only one psilocybin session here. More for experimental reasons, I still think at least two sessions is probably helpful because you do get some variability. You get some sessions where people said it's not that meaningful. But we're actually, our colleagues at NIDA Intramural next door on our campus, Elliot Stein's lab, was so excited about our data, they offered some free imaging, fMRI, pre and post, to start to understand what the heck is going on here. And so more for those experimental reasons, we want to see biological correlates of potential success. So for experimental reasons, we wanted to reduce noise and just kind of scale it down to one session. And then the next slide, I'm showing you 7-day point prevalence data currently, so that note the changing in throughout because people are trickling through the study. But so it's ongoing. It could change, but it's very encouraging to date. The people, 28 folks that have gotten to 12 months, we have 56% of participants biologically confirmed as abstinent compared to 17% at with nicotine patch. And so you do have, as you go across these numbers, you have both, you know, within subject and between subject differences since the N itself changes. Given, you know, people are still moving through. Some people have gotten to 6 months that haven't gotten to 12 months, for example. But it might suggest that you, where psilocybin treatment has its real impact is really maintaining abstinence over time. So, again, we'll see if that holds up. But it really seems that, like, gosh, at the 12-month, that's where the differential is really apparent. And we are getting, like, even for nicotine patch, we're getting some really good relative treatment success compared to what's typically reported in the literature. Then the next slide, just showing you some brief data, briefly on a subset of data that's been analyzed in Elliot Stein's lab. On the MCIT, this is a measure of cognitive control. So they conduct this neuropsychological task both before they quit and after. We're doing fMRI at during this task to look at the brain response as well. But this is and I should say on the before they quit, we are having them go through just a temporary 24-hour smoking break so that nicotine on board is not a confound. And then we're comparing that to, in the post data, to 24 hours after their psilocybin session. So MCID, if it's kind of like the Stroop task, you have to inhibit some prepotent tendency, so you're asked to, like, tell us which one of these numbers is not like the other two, so what's the oddball digit, and then you have to use your finger number that is the same as that number, and everyone's temptation is to use the finger that is in the same spatial location, the same position, and you've got to resist that, and just think about the number, what's the number one? Oh, I use my index finger because that's finger number one. Some trials, those two things jive with each other, and other times they're inconsistent, so you subtract the reaction times and you get this sort of cognitive interference score to see how well you do with overriding that conflicting information. And then on the next slide, I'm showing you that we do see psilocybin group is showing less of this interference effect the day after quitting. So again, we'll see if that holds up, but that seems so far to be suggestive that the anecdotes people are sometimes sharing with us, that it sounds like they're more mindful afterwards, that folks will say, well, I get cravings, but I kind of see them coming, you know, and I tell myself, hey, I've quit smoking, and it'll be gone in a few minutes, and that's okay. So they're kind of less easily kind of tripped up by the craving that comes out of nowhere. Next slide, alcohol dependence pilot. So my good colleague Mike Bogenschutz at New York University, he did this pilot when he was at University of New Mexico. He's at NYU now, but very similar to our tobacco pilot, showed large reductions in drinking days. This is all self-report, and heavy drinking days after a psilocybin intervention. He too has, and this was two sessions, he too has followed up with a randomized larger trial with 100 people that he's currently conducting based on these promising early data. Next, I'm showing you just some data that we recently published looking at some sort of we've done a number of studies. I'm just showing you, I think, the alcohol one here of people who have stories about, hey, you know, they'll say, like, oh, I quit. I was addicted to whatever. And we've done this with a number of drugs now, ranging from alcohol to cigarette smoking to cannabis to opioids to cocaine. There are stories out there that people say they had a big old psychedelic experience, typically because they just wanted to have fun. And then they were like, what the heck am I doing with my life? This kind of session prompted this, you know, deep thinking, and they quit the substance. And sometimes those stories were like, you know, 20 years ago. Sometimes it was a week ago. So we've collected these stories and tried to see what we could figure out. One of the things that shook out was a structural equation model that I'm showing you here, where it looked like the dose of psychedelic, and again, you can't determine causality here, but with the structural equation modeling, this is suggestive of potential causality, that the dose might have prompted both whether they had insightful experiences and mystical-type experiences, those two determining whether the experience was judged meaningful. and then that contributed to whether they changed their decreased their drinking, and that was also related to their pre-psychedelic use alcohol severity scores. So thinking towards the end here, slide label, understanding psychedelic behavior change, folks should be thinking, okay, you showed me a lot of different disorders, and okay, it works for everything. It might smell of snake oil. So that's important skepticism to keep keep in mind, and we have got to follow the data. But if it holds up, I would suggest that the commonality across these disorders might be that there's a narrowing behavioral and mental repertoire. So I kind of think of these as addiction broadly defined. And so whether you're talking about the behavioral and mental ruts associated with the repeated substance use to the exclusion of other reinforcers in life, or with or with being stuck in thinking about yourself in a certain way and going through life and sort of the rut that can be depression, that these are sort of addictions broadly defined. People are stuck in sort of this narrow behavioral repertoire. And so some interesting data that others have published and that we've replicated, haven't published yet, show that kind of acutely that psychedelics have a massive increase. They cause massive increases in global brain network dynamics. In other words, brain areas that normally are relatively independent are massively synchronized with each other. It could be that this is related to insightful experiences and long-term changes in behavior. We're looking at that. No one has data really to relate these to the long-term changes. We're looking at that right now in our smoking cessation work. But it could be that these kind of narrowed behavioral mental repertoires are related to these to overly rigid brain network dynamics, and we do know that a number of disorders are now associated with this sort of these sort of suboptimal or at least abnormal patterns in resting state imaging, which is the method that's used to look at this brain synchronization I'm talking about. And then I think my next bullet point is, you know, it's just these are also interesting data for just contemplating the endogenous role of the 2A receptors in the brain, which we still know very little about. We know that they seem to be major computational units in the cortex on pyramidal cells, and that they may have something really fundamental, powerfully to do with mental and behavioral plasticity, perhaps meaning making. So more to come, hopefully, if we can figure out some stuff along that sort of outside of just the psychedelics, but just tools and understanding brain function and how it relates to psychology. And I think my last slide is just kind of summing up what I just showed you is the dope slap effect. So in Michael Pollan's recent book, he focused on this kind of new psychedelic research in the last couple of decades. And this highly scientific term of dope slap is something I didn't really remember saying, but it sounds like something I would say, but basically people are dope slapped out of their stories. It basically people come out of these sessions typically with a story to tell about the experience, and that relates to self-identity. And it seems that these sessions, when optimally conducted, had the potential to open a window of mental flexibility in which people can learn something. They can temporarily let go of their mental models that they use to organize reality, and then, you know, in that state of plasticity, they can learn something that can have long-term positive effects. And that plasticity is probably related to the potential negative effects outside of a therapeutic context. Next slide, I'm just kind of repeating my acknowledgement slide. That's it for me. And if we have time for questions, I'm happy to do what I can to answer them.
Well, first
Hi,
of all,
this is,
oh, go ahead.
I'm sorry, is it time for questions?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, great. I was just curious, did any of the participants have previous experience with utilizing psilocybin or any type of psychedelics?
So that varied across our studies. The very first study in 36 participants, nobody had that experience. In the next dose effect study in healthy normals, there was a small minority of people with that experience, but we made sure that it was it was typically like decades ago, like they tried it in college and there was very little, there was no meaningful effect for those people because we really wanted to avoid people who had already had these kind of salient self-described, you know, effects. And then in other studies, it's just varied. So there was a subset of people in both in the therapeutic studies. We've looked and we have not found evidence that there is a relationship to having that experience before. And in fact, anecdotally, well, we have the numbers to really have power on this question, but sometimes people come in with a recreational background and it's like you have to overcome the bad habits. Like they come in with some assumptions like, in a recreational setting, like at a concert, the tendency is to kind of hold yourself together, you know, and you don't want to be the person in the corner crying about your mom and, like, you know, and about the fact that, wow, I really drink too much, if that's occurring to you, you know, right. You don't want to be a drama king or queen. And so in our studies, it's like, okay, no, that's exactly what you're supposed to be doing if that's occurring to you. Cry it out. You know, we're going to hold your hand through it to help you through the experience. So sometimes, you know, so that's kind of my anecdotal, you know, experience with that. But, yeah, we don't see a relationship there. And, yeah, hopefully that's about all I know about that.
Okay, thank you so much.
Mm-hmm.
Matt, this is Mark Shanker again. I'm wondering why the research went from LSD to psilocybin, if there's an advantage to the psilocybin. And I'm also wondering if you could say anything about microdosing.
Right. So the biggest factor, I like to joke and say, it kind of relates to the spelling of, you know, of these compounds. So psilocybin is actually a little bit hard to spell for some people. I still often misspell it, even though I've been working with it 15 years. But at least it's not spelled LSD. You know, this was the drug for the folks around in the late 60s and early 70s, and I was born in 74, but it was LSD that's what was on the street, and that's what, you know, Jimi Hendrix was talking about when he said, "Are you experienced?" It was LSD, and that was the thing that, you know, folks were saying was disintegrating society. So the cultural baggage is just much stronger for LSD, even though pharmacologically, I mean, you know, it's sort of like with other drug classes. This is like, you know, Valium versus Xanax. Like, there are more similarities than differences. The same major neuropharmacological profile, although certainly differences. There's some different secondary receptors that are differentially activated. But it is easier to fit in a workday. So that is something that's practical. You don't have to keep people overnight or keep them for 12 to 16-hour days. So psilocybin is about a 5 to 6-hour experience, and we can send someone home at 5 or 6 o'clock in the evening with a loved one driving them home. And if you dose them at 8 a.m. with LSD, depending on the dose, they're going to be around until at least 8 p.m. And at a high dose, they're going to be around till midnight. So that it makes it a bit easier. But, in fact, there still is much more data, even on the safety with LSD, because so much work was done in the early days. I do think there should be some modern research with LSD, but it was, frankly, the biggest factor was probably political, that kind of association with the counterculture that's strongest for LSD.
Okay, and is there any information on microdosing at this point?
Right, thanks for the reminder. There have been two laboratory studies that have been published, one from Britain, one Harriet DeWitt's lab in Chicago published. Quick summary is that they failed to show any benefit. The only effects that have been shown are just mild impairment in terms of, like, time estimation, or I think it's time reproduction with the exact construct that was used. And in Harriet's study, slight elevations in abuse-related subjective effects, which is, you know, what you would expect if you get a little bit of a drug with, you know, liking and things like that, ratings of feeling high, and if you get the dose high enough, you're going to get that. So even though they probed for it, they haven't found any sort of measures that map onto the anecdotes that seem to abound now. There was one study that I don't really trust the data published pre and post truffle use That's kind of the legal version of mushrooms. The mushrooms are technically illegal, but the mycelia that create the mushroom, it's a trivial difference, but you can sell the truffles in Amsterdam just because of a technicality in law, and they did pre and post on some of these cognitive measures. It was open label. You're talking about differences here that are, you know, get down to the, like, the reaction time, subtle differences. So, gosh, with stuff like this with such a strong expectancy bias that relate to those types of measures, I really don't trust them unless it's under blind conditions. So you could also say some of our the lab studies, and I think Harry would admit this and all the folks that have done it, so far they have failed to replicate the real methods that folks are saying, you know, is the way it works. Like folks will say, oh, you take it only once every 4 days, you know, go out and do your daily routine. You know, the only thing that's been done is these laboratory sessions with the acute effects. So maybe we haven't looked at it the right way as a field, but nothing so far even hints at these, you know, positive therapeutic effects. The most interesting thing to me is antidepressant effects, because we need all the help we can. I mean, we're in a suicidality crisis. I mean, this is a novel, a different way of tinkering with the serotonin system. So if small doses are basically another version of an SSRI that might work for some people where other drugs don't, like, that's really worth exploring. But, yeah, so it's very plausible that some of these effects are real. I strongly suspect a good amount of the anecdotes are placebo effect. I think reality is probably somewhere in between.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
I think we have time for one more question. I'm the clocker here.
I have a question.
You can go ahead.
I was just wondering if, as far as safety, this is safe for somebody with bipolar. And then my follow-up is kind of that a lot of the research around the ketamine and bipolar treatments also link to this kind of mystical experience. And I'm wondering if what your thoughts are on this, if it's like a similar experience as far as healing goes.
Yeah, so we have excluded for bipolar in our studies, and that is erring on the cautious side. We really don't know, and a big part of that is because, you know, so much of this early research, it's based upon these, you know, the clinical experience in the 60s and even going back to the 50s, where the diagnostic categories, like what would be called bipolar now, might in fact been labeled schizophrenia back in the day, certainly depending on the clinician. So, you know, we are going for, one colleague put it, space shuttle level safety at this point, not your typical automobile on the road level of safety. So we might be over cautious there, but I think this is the right place to start. I could imagine, frankly, just this is speculation, that if you're prone to a manic phase, I think kind of a strong psychedelic is probably not a good idea. And I'll just say, in terms of ketamine, I think that's where a lot of empirical work needs to go. There may, in fact, be a lot of common pathways. There's some really early there's some data suggesting different forms of neuroplasticity in the cortex that are common between the classic psychedelics and NMDA antagonists. And we don't know if these are related to the clinical therapeutic effects, but hopefully we will know at some point soon. And so, yeah, there's a potential biological commonality there with ketamine. And the other thing is, I think we've been treating this stuff as basically medication-facilitated therapy, essentially, psychotherapy. Like, we tell people, you're going to have experience that you might learn from. And the typical experience, the way ketamine works, is certainly the approved Spravato use, is, oh, you're going to feel different, ignore that. That doesn't have anything to do with, you know, the expected efficacy. I think some really interesting experimental work would be, randomizing people to have kind of our psychedelic-type model versus the current model of just the straight-up biological effect that is divorced from any modulation by, you know, expectancy and, you know, set and setting, so to speak. And could we get longer lasting? I mean, the average antidepressant effects are about 1 week now with ketamine. And could you extend that by treating it the way we're treating psilocybin? I don't know. Interesting work to be done there, though.
Hi, this is Mark Schenker, and it's 2 o'clock, so you're free to go, Mac. But I mean, if you want to stay on for a couple of minutes,
I'll stay on for a couple of minutes in case there's one or two more questions. And if folks are dinging out, I won't be offended by the ding that rings in, because I know you probably many of you have places to go.
But listen, before any of that, I want to thank you. This is a wonderful talk. It's really really stimulating, really give me a lot to think about.
My pleasure.
Appreciate your time. I'm going to go now put on some Jimi Hendrix.
I have a question.
Right.
It's a theoretical question.
Uh-huh.
Can you hear me?
Yes, yes.
So I was just, listening to, your whole talk, and what struck me as part of the theory development piece that you're working on, I was just wondering if generally your group is postulating that the beneficial effects that you see that are not apparent in the microdosing but only seem to be apparent correlated to mystical experience and
mm-hmm.
then the neurological, aspect. I was just wondering, all of that sounds like integration, so like self-integration and neurological integration, physiologically, mentally, spiritually, I guess. Is that kind of the theoretical direction it seems to be forming from your research?
That's, you actually put it really probably better than I would have put it. Like, that's exactly what we're thinking. The important thing is I think these are, like, really empirical questions, so we just need more research. There are biological threads. I mentioned the potential neuroplasticity that may suggest that part of what we're seeing is straight-up biological. I mean, I think about the ibogaine work, and ibogaine is complex. It's not a classic psychedelic, but it does have 2A effects, but it also has an NMDA antagonist effects like ketamine, kappa-opioid agonist activity, like another hallucinogen, salvinorin A. It's like this really kind of dirty pharmacological agent. But we know there's a really heavy trip, so to speak, from it, but nonetheless, rats will stop pressing, they'll stop self-administering cocaine and opioids. And some good preclinical work shows that there's a normalization in the mesolimbic. Now, you could postulate that this, is mediated by this mystical experience in the rat, and maybe there is, maybe there isn't, but, at the biological level, it looks like this. Certainly it's not an optimal set and setting, a rat in a cage
mm-hmm.
with a bar. So it appears in that case that there is kind of this straight-up biological story. My best
mm-hmm.
guess is that, I think clearly, like ketamine, if there's a commonality there, there's a straight-up biological side. It can certainly work when you completely ignore, the set and setting, the psychological preparation. I think what we're seeing is probably a combination of both. There's probably some, which is why you see it. Sometimes people just take mushrooms at a concert and they sometimes have these therapeutic-like effects under suboptimal conditions.
Mm-hmm.
I think the kind of the gain isn't turned up as high in those cases, but certainly
mm-hmm.
the risks are higher. But I think probably with psilocybin, what we're seeing is probably a combination of multiple biological mechanisms and what can be best thought of is essentially a learning experience. I think the long-term effects, when someone is better in some respect 6 months from now, I think that's more in the category that you all as psychologists understand more than the biologically oriented folks.
Mm-hmm.
This is more like from psychotherapy. Someone has a story they can tell you about this experience they had and how it changed their life, much like you can say, oh, this is what I was like before I was married, and this is how my life is different. Or, this is the
mm-hmm.
time I visited another culture for the first time, and that profoundly, taught me these lessons, and I'm different in these ways. It's kind of more like that than – and the stuff that you hope to get in, behavior, different forms of psychological therapy. And, for most effective psychological therapies, we have no idea about the full biological story that's going on there. But presumably there's a biology underlying all of it. So, I think we're kind of in this in-between world where I think my best guess is that the long-term effects are best explained psychologically, even though that sounds like a lot of woo-woo to some of the folks on the neuroscience side. And it's understandable because it's a medication. Most psychiatric medications aren't about this thing that you learn during the active drug effects. So it's something that makes it really exciting because there's a ton to figure out here.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it even could be something very simple, like when people are, when their consciousness is altered and expanded, then they just automatically start integrating physiologically. And I mean,
yeah,
you know, in other words, just getting out of the way of themselves, because normally
right.
the mental part is like interested in controlling things and categorizing and all of this kind of stuff. But if that's just sort of knocked aside, then the organism can just do what it's naturally going to do because it's naturally in an integrated state. And so like
right.
living in that fragmented state is necessary in civilization, but it's not a natural state. So they can just kind of go right back into the natural, maybe, you know, maybe that's, anyway, I love the theory.
Right.
I love theory development. So that's where my mind goes with it.
Right. Right. And I think this is a really interesting area for that. And what you said makes sense. And there's many ways to look at it. I mean, I kind of think about just the most basic learning theory, like Pavlovian learning theory research. One of the most important things there is the role of context. It modulates everything. I mean,
mm-hmm.
as far as we know, there's no forgetting. It's just kind of a failure to retrieve, you know, when you shift the context, and all of a sudden you can, you know, get these memories back. And so, you know, you could look at these experiences as like a powerful form of manipulating interoceptive context in people. That
mm-hmm.
what that might mean is people kind of get out of their own way. And something I didn't mention is that there's some very related to the global network effects. You get an increase in these global synchronizations at the expense of the decoupling of local networks. And one of those networks that's decoupled is the default mode network, which is associated with self-referential processing. When you think about yourself, remember yourself, project yourself into the future, the default mode network is more active. So acutely on psilocybin, that activity is decoupled, which is correlated to the sense of unity. So this might be literally, biologically speaking, like getting out of your own way. Like some of these disorders might be sort of a disorder of the burden of the self, you know, the self-persecutory
yeah.
thoughts and depression, for example, or even an addiction, like, you know, I'm just a smoker. I might as well admit it. I'm going to be a smoker the rest. I just can't do this. These stories we tell ourselves, and you blow out of that context, and it's like, oh, actually, it's not that hard.
Yeah, right. The context is so expanded, and all possibilities are opened, and the natural state is allowed because they don't have to function in the industrialized way. So, yeah, it's just really fascinating.
So
happy you're doing this work. And, yeah.
Oh, thank you. And my hope and all of our – I think for everyone in the field, like, we hope as many people jump into this field because there's just more – like, you give a talk and it's like most of the questions are usually – the answer is – we don't know. We need more research on that. So just the field needs to grow. And hopefully there's going to be – I think the last kind of peg and you know, kind of this growing research is just there hasn't really been federal funding for the therapeutic research. I think that's going to change soon. And I think that's – you know, there's been sort of this modern renaissance, and I think it's going to grow a lot, especially when we keep focusing on, like, yeah, there's risks, you know, but we're taking that seriously. And these are powerful tools, and that you can learn a lot from them. And yeah.
Hey, I have a quick question about research about using your tool that you designed and was recently validated to detect the the mystical experiences.
Right.
Is that open for researchers to use? And the reason I'm asking is I have some colleagues who do very intensive outdoor retreat psychotherapy work, so it's nature oriented, and many people have these very similar kinds of experiences that you described, people on psilocybin. They don't use drugs, but they're very similar sounding experiences, and I was just wondering if someone could just collect that data and just have it available for anyone that wants it.
Absolutely, it's free to use, and if you send me an email, I'm happy to We actually should. I don't think it's up on our – we should put it on our website. We have a good lab website now. But, yeah, it's absolutely free to use. You can email me at mwj@jhu. It's on my acknowledgement slide, my email. And I'll send you a copy, and it's only 30 items. That's why we call it the MEQ30. So, and absolutely, we designed it. There's no reference to drugs. It's our framing of it, even though we validate it with the drug experiences, is this is designed for acute experiences. So whether it's nature exposure, some type of retreat, like absolutely. And I really hope that more folks use it in that way. So that'd be really exciting.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Yeah.
Hi, one little question for me. Are you familiar with George Kelly's rep test?
I don't think so, unless you start describing it, it might ring some bells.
I was reminded of it when you were talking about one of the mechanisms is the loosening of constructs.
Mm-hmm.
And George Kelly's theory involves looking at rigidity of personal constructs and fluidity of personal constructs, and he developed a test to measure how rigid or flexible people's personal constructs were. And I thought that might be a useful tool for you.
Yeah, it absolutely does sound, and I don't think this is one that I've looked into. So this is George Kelly, and it's called the what test, REF or REG?
Role Construct Repertory Test. I'll send you a link to it.
Okay, wonderful. I'd appreciate that.
Yeah, because it would be right up that alley. Kelly was a long time ago.
Okay. Oh, wonderful. Yeah, I'd really appreciate that. Because I think we're still in our infancy here. Like, you know, we haven't even honed in on the right outcomes for sure, you know. And even we're getting some correlates. Like, I think there's probably better constructs out there that might more squarely kind of get to the thing that that might be going on. So that's great.
One quick question from me, David Abelson here. You know, CBT is not usually associated with mystical experiences. You know, post-psilocybin, what is it that you guys think would be the most optimal therapeutic experience to help shape and support the mystical experience?
You know, I don't know. It's an empirical question. Just kind of guessing here, you know, mindfulness-based relapse prevention might be something. We, in fact, do have we have a little bit of that. We have the Kabat-Zinn body scan and our CBT. So there's a little sort of, you know, a few non-traditional CBT components included in there. But frankly, one of the considerations is it's, you know, some of the, like, CBT can be treated more outside of the box. A lot of studies are done with, you know, like, you know, undergraduate-level research assistants delivering it, at least for smoking cessation. So some of those considerations contributed to the decision to go with CBT. But, yeah, mindfulness kind of comes to mind, especially for folks that, you know, really have a, you know, clinical experience and expertise in delivering those interventions. Mike Bogenschutz is using, who did the alcohol work at NYU, he's using motivational enhancement therapy or motivational interviewing. So he's getting good results too. So those are some thoughts that come to mind. And there's probably other things. I mean, we've barely taken a stab at just a few things.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Larissa, I have a very quick question regarding self-treatment with psychedelic drugs. That's one of the modules we have in this year's Global Drug Survey. And looking at your results and, like, all the media attention that you get, of course, some people who cannot participate in the studies or are not represented are deciding to use these drugs as a self-treatment, and ideally there would be integration prior and after. But what would be your recommendation based on the studies for people who will go along before all these things are approved as therapy?
Yeah, so that's interesting. And I don't know whether I don't think we've been on the emails together, but, yeah, I've helped, you know, Adam and Wade in with some other folks, you know, to help inform that. You probably, know that. And we so it's interesting. So I've got to – I think we need to learn as much as possible from naturalistic use. In terms of, you know, making recommendations for people, that's kind of where I, you know, have to draw the limit to just, you know, to say, look, there are risks. I can't encourage any use. What I do like to say is here's what we know about what makes for safer or more risky, less risky use in the human being in general, just scientifically, and that comes along with things like not being alone, not everyone being on the substance, know what the heck you're taking, have some knowledge about what the nature of the, what the dose is of what the person is taking. Certainly not doing anything like, operating a motor vehicle, taking care of children, having any sort of, responsibility in the kind of the external world. Those kind of float to the top of the list in terms of just, things I tell someone, this is what we know differentiates riskier versus less risky use.
Is there anything related to frequency of use that you could see?
I don't think so. I mean, empirically, I don't think, my impression is that, you're going to get an asymptote you're going to get diminishing returns of any benefit. And in fact, you might have more of an inverted U. In other words, using too frequently is probably going to cause, problems. And there's really no real science on right now to indicate what that is. I think the general, going back decades, most folks have said, gosh, one of the big lessons is if you're going to use these things, focus on, again, not to encourage someone to use, outside of an approved context, but if someone's going to use, focus on, if you thought you came away from the last experience with any lessons, make sure you've kind of done your homework before you just keep going back to the well. Integrate the experiences rather than just kind of going back to the to the source. And I do think there's some work of, again, it's unknown, but my impression is you have some personality disorder and some kind of some problems that come with really heavy use. I think, people think they've kind of dissolved their ego and they're enlightened, and the people around them think, wow, that's one of the most self-absorbed people I've ever met. And you can get this sometimes with heavy psychedelic users, certainly not all. And who knows how much of that is pre-existing pathology that leads them to be a very frequent user, and how much of that is an exacerbation. My gut is that there's a little bit of both there. And there's some so-called ego inflation going on with some folks. I mean, there's just, again, we just need so much more research, and maybe some, shaking out of the global drug survey could help to inform that. So, yeah. Cool. Especially if you guys are willing to keep this kind of focus in there.
Thank you.
Yeah. You're welcome.
All right. I think we've taken up plenty of your time.
Okay. Well, thanks a lot for the attention to this area. So, again, if anything, I can email someone. Feel free to shoot me an email, like the MEQ. And, just thanks a lot.
All right. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Take care. Bye.
Bye, everybody.
Bye.
Bye.